You're listening to Mammal Watching with Charles Foley and John Hall. You can find other episodes at mammalwatching.com/podcast.
Welcome to the Mammal Watching podcast with me, John Hall, in Ivory Coast.
And me, Charles Foley, also in Ivory Coast. Good to see you here, John.
It's nice to see you, Charles. What are the odds? Welcome to season three, the start of season three of the podcast. So Charles and I are sitting on the veranda of the Ecotel on the edge of Thai National Forest. We've just spent a week in Camp Chimpanzee. The sun is setting, the cicadas are chirping, the monkeys are getting ready to go to sleep. And I am listening to Charles speak impeccable French as he just explained to the wonderful chef here that she needed to be silenced because we were recording an important episode. I think that's what she understood.
I have no idea what she understood, John. In fact, you've made a bit of a habit of spending a few minutes trying to deduce what it is I was trying to say and then informing me what it was that I actually said. And there seems to be relatively little overlap between the two. But anyway, onwards, nous marchons.
We have been torturing the French language to death, right. But it's been effective. Not pleasant.
It has, and we have seen some amazing things, haven't we?
Yes, we have seen some great stuff. It's surprised me how much cool stuff we've seen. It wasn't we didn't see the stuff that I was expecting, but we saw a whole other set of stuff instead, which is even better, I think, than the targets I came into this trip on. How do you feel about it, Charles?
Yes, so I guess the big miss was the zebra diker. Yeah. And we had a bead on it. We were sitting, staking it out. The guide saw it for about 20 seconds, and we managed to miss it. So that was not a good night.
No, and it was close. It wasn't like we missed it from 100 meters. It was about 10 meters in front of us.
Yeah, yeah. So that was definitely an oops. But then we returned to the same site. Waited for a few hours, and as it got dark, we found something in the thermal, and it was a smallish, medium-sized carnivore, and my immediate thought was that it was a genet. So I said, it's a genet, and you started making the squeaking noises, and it responded, and it started walking.
Responded very well, very, very, very well. Soft squeaking, sort of almost as quiet as you can, just a... It doesn't even come through the mic.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, very soft sound. And it proceeded to walk directly towards us.
It ran.
It did. It's like, yes, trotted straight to us. So at that point, when it's about, I know, 10 feet away or so, we switch on the torch. And the first thing that I noticed was, hey, this thing is not black and white. It is actually a dark brown color, and it has an enormous nose.
It does, an absolute huge hooter.
Right, and it took a little while to process, and as the brain was engaging, both you and Kevin, who was our excellent guide, exclaimed at exactly the same time, Liberian mongoose.
Yeah.
An amazing sighting.
Incredible. I mean, you could tell how amazing it was by how excited our guide was. He was in a bit of a funk because we'd missed the zebra diker from the day before, I think. But he was, you know, he's been working in this park for 18 years, leading tourists and also a lot of research with the chimp trackers. There's chimp research here. So in the field, you know, every day, walking through the forest, he's seen one Liberian mongoose once in 18 years. And that was a distant, brief sighting of an animal. I think the chimps flushed.
Yeah.
If we understood correctly.
Yes, that's right.
I'm quite sure with our translation.
Right, yes. Something along those lines. But it was just astonishing because it was an animal that is incredibly rare. So it was first discovered in the late 1950s, but it wasn't actually captured and seen until the late 1980s.
The late 30 years to actually catch a live one.
That's, yeah.
It shows how rare it is.
Right.
I reckon it might be the last new carnivore described. I'm trying to think. Someone please correct me there, but I'm trying to think of something more recent.
Yeah. That's definitely a possibility. And it's got a tiny range. Effectively, it is really only known from the Thai National Park and a tiny bit of the surrounding environment. And that's it.
Yeah. And it like sandy soils, which we were on the edge of a dry sort of creek bed, and it apparently they forage there for earthworms, and that's maybe what it was doing. But it was in the dark, and everything I've read said they're diurnal. So, but yeah, it's just, other people have been here and they've spent quite a bit of time looking for it, and then you know it's very very difficult animal I think to find, to pin down because they wander. And yet here he was, and I think really, if we hadn't turned on the light when we did, it would have landed on our laps. It was kind of bounding like a happy dog running towards us, sort of up and down, and just that. I don't know if it thought I was a female Liberian mongoose or a mouse it was could eat or something, but it was really keen to get to know us.
Yeah, definitely. It's and just again an astonishing sighting. One that it wasn't even on my radar, to be honest. I just really didn't think that we would see it. And an amazing looking animal. It just, as I said, it had this fantastic snout. It looked a bit like Pinocchio, and an absolute highlight. So very very pleased.
It absolutely made missing the zebra dyker more palatable, because I would have been gutted. I am still gutted that we missed it. But as Charles rightly pointed out, everything happens for a reason. And if we had both seen the zebra dyker that fateful afternoon, we wouldn't have returned the next day. And a Liberian mongoose beats a zebra dyker for me, hands down, because it's, I mean, I love my small carnivores, as does Charles, but such a rare animal. So cool to see.
Yeah. So, and by and large, I have to admit, I've been very impressed by Thai National Park. Yes, there is poaching still happening. You occasionally hear gunshots around, but it's got a good vibe to it. I like the Ivorian people. The whole country seems to be in a good mood. It's probably because they've just won the African Cup of Football. But anyway, it's a great country, nice national park, really good wildlife. So, yeah, we'd encourage people to come.
Yeah, there'll be a trip report soon. Maybe it's even up by the time season 3 starts. But lots of pygmy hippo sign here. They do not seem uncommon. Not easy to see, I'm sure. But along the river, there's tracks everywhere. Elephants, monkeys all over the place. Not particularly scared of people, but hard to photograph. It's not a photographer's paradise, I think, because of the habitat. We also got a white-bellied pangolin, which was another great one to see, and about 30 species all up.
Yep. So, as I said, great place to visit. Our guest today is Peter Kaestner. Now, Peter has worked for many years as an American diplomat and indeed ambassador, traveling and living all around the world, though he retired in 2016. However, what Peter is best known for, certainly in the birding world, is that he is the world's number one bird lister, meaning that he has seen more bird species than any other person. And you may have read about Peter in the news recently, because this year he is on course to become the first person in history to see over 10,000 bird species, which would be a phenomenal achievement. Peter, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you here.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
Welcome, Peter. It's really great to meet you.
Nice to meet you guys.
I must admit, it's rather wonderful to have both the world's number one bird lister and number one mammal lister together on the same program. and am I right in saying that you guys haven't actually met in person yet?
No. You are right. Yes, the answer is yes, you are right. We haven't right. met.
Which is remarkable, really. So, why don't you get us started by telling us how you first became interested in birds?
Oh, my goodness. I've always been interested in birds. And it turns out that I have a brother 8 years older than I, and he saw his spark bird when he was 10 years old and I was just 2. So my older brother, who I adored when I was young, became a birder at about 10. And as I progressed after 2, 4, 5 years old, I just started doing it because my brother was doing it. And I have a photograph on my eBird profile page of me standing there with a pair of binoculars around by my knees at age 4, I believe.
And when did the listing start? Was that your brother as well that got you into that?
Yeah, no, it's always, our family is horribly competitive. I mean, incredibly competitive. We competed on absolutely every aspect of life. I have 6 brothers and 3 sisters, and my father is in the Lacrosse Hall of Fame. My older brother is in the Lacrosse Hall of Fame. I have two other brothers that were all American athletes. It was everything was competition. And yes, I have kept a life list from pretty much the very start. I have an old Peterson guide with my life list in the front when I had only seen about 300 birds.
So as I mentioned at the start, you had a career in the Foreign Service for many, many years, and that obviously took you all around the world. And was that career choice in any way driven by birding, or was it simple serendipity?
100% driven by birding.
Okay.
And the great thing about it is very different from the way the UK works. In the United States, to become a diplomat, you have to pass a test. That's it. The only requirements are to be 21 years old and an American citizen. So I could be an immigrant from Africa. If I'm 21 years old, I've become naturalized, I'm a U.S. citizen, I can take the test and pass it. In fact, there is an American ambassador, I think he's still serving in Africa, named Tuli Mushingi, who is from Eastern Congo and is a naturalized American citizen. He spent his formative years in a little tiny village in the eastern part of the Congo, near, not too far from Goma, and married an American citizen, came here, got a PhD in linguistics at Dartmouth, and took the Foreign Service test and has had a very successful career representing our country as a very recent diplomat. And of course, not now recent, but at the time he became a diplomat, he had only recently become an American citizen.
Hmm. Fantastic. So, he also sounds like he might be the person who can help us find an Okapi, Charles. So we may need to try and track this man down. But.
So you made an actual choice. You said, okay, what job is going to take me around the world and give me the opportunity to see the most birds? And you settled on the Foreign Service. Is that how it worked?
Pretty much, yeah, pretty much. And my oldest brother, the one that started me on this whole thing, got a job working for a local company here in Baltimore called the McCormick Spice Company. And he was a spice buyer. And he traveled around the world, especially to tropical places like Madagascar. He went there, I think, 30 or 40 times, buying spices, and had a long and decorated career. He was interesting. They wanted to promote him into jobs of more responsibility, but he kept saying no. He said that he met many times with the corporate shrinks because they couldn't understand why he wouldn't want more money and more responsibility. And he was very happy buying spices and traveling around the world. And right now, he's one of the top 10 e-birders in the world, almost entirely because of his spice buying. So when I was in university, I went to university with the idea of becoming an ornithologist. And I got some advice from a wise person that said, if I became an ornithologist, I would lose my hobby, because then my birding and my profession and avocation would be too similar. And I think it was a very good advice, because I had a fabulous career as a diplomat. It's being a diplomat is a real honor to be able to represent your country around the world to other countries and other people. And I had a type of job in the Foreign Service that was service oriented. One of my main things, we did visas, as I mentioned earlier before the recording, but also we took care of American citizens. So if an American citizen ended up in jail or in the hospital, then I would go and visit them and help them and provide services to them.
Hmm. And were you well known in the diplomatic corps for your birding, or did you try and keep quiet?
Yes, no. We have a sort of an internal state magazine that's, you know, we have 20,000 or so employees, so we have our own magazine, and I think I appeared in that 3 times during my career. I was very well known as a birder.
Fantastic. And how much choice did you have for postings? Were you deliberately going to countries that were next to the list for sort of birds?
Yeah, that sort of evolved over time. Initially, it was 100% birds. Then I started in 1981. I went to India and Papua New Guinea and the Solomon Islands. And I came back to Washington. And while I was in Washington, I met my wife and we got married. So once I got married, my wife got a job as a diplomat also. She was a computer specialist, a computer officer. So she would run the communications and computers in the embassy, and I would work in the consular section. And then once that happened, then we had to coordinate a little bit. But still, birds were a very, very important part. And then we had children. And then once we had children, then the schooling became important. We couldn't go to a place that had crappy schools, so we would go to places with good schools. And then finally, when I became very senior, I ended up retiring at a level in the diplomatic corps that is equivalent of a 2-star general in the armed services. So I was a fairly high ranking person. Then at that point, I would go to places where the State Department wanted me to go rather than where I could see birds. So yeah, it changed over time, but initially it was all about the birds.
That's the way to do it. It does echo a little bit my life of sort of trying to travel around the world and get jobs which would help me see mammals. But
yeah.
You're in the Foreign Service, you're being posted to these very bird rich countries. When did the dream of hitting 10,000 unfold?
That was very recent. And part of the reason that it was recent is when I was in university, the world list of birds was only 8,600. So getting to 10,000 was absolutely impossible. So it's only been in the last decade or so that the number of birds has reached a point where getting 10,000 was possible. And to get to 10,000 at this point, you need to see between 90 and 91% of all the birds. And that percentage, if you know, another 20 years or so, 90% of the world's birds might get you 12 or 13,000 birds because of the splitting and the number of birds that's increasing. So it really only happened, I'm going to say about five years ago, I started really focusing on it. When I got to 9,000, I think it was 2018, then I realized that the last 1,000 were really quite doable.
Right.
Wow. Were you the first to 9,000?
No. Tom Gullick was.
He was British, wasn't he?
Tom Gullick. Yeah, he was a Brit that lived in Madrid. He passed away a couple of years ago.
And if you given thought, I mean, I think about this a lot, what is it about listing that is so satisfying or so important to you?
Yeah, it's when I think of birding, I don't think of listing per se. Listing is one of the facets of birding to me. And I enjoy it. As I had mentioned earlier, I come from a very competitive background. And indeed, my wife is a very competitive person. So we're always competitive. We've taken up pickleball recently, and I, you know, I'm arranging to get lessons so that I can improve my pickleball game and become more competitive. So yeah, everything is competitive in my life. So that is the listening part helps feed that part of my personality. But also I have a tremendous scientific interest in birds. I was very nearly a professional ornithologist. I really enjoy the biology of birds. I love the beauty of birds. I love, you know, the marvel of migration, the you know, spectacle of a bald eagle soaring overhead and its white tail and head glistening in the sun. You know, even a robin. I used to walk to work when we lived in Frankfurt, and as I walked along, I would duck into an old cemetery and walk through the cemetery and then pop back out. And there was a couple of pairs of robins in that cemetery, and they would be singing most of the year. And I would often just stop and listen to this extraordinary ethereal song of the European robin. Never tired of it, ever, ever, ever. And it's, you know, there's just so many aspects. I enjoy sharing birds with people. I work as a part-time tour guide for Rock Jumper Tours. And, you know, the only reason I do that is just to be able to share my knowledge and and experiences with people, just to, because I love doing it. I love sharing what I have. I love helping people. There are just so many different reasons for birding for me. It's just, it's so intertwined in my personality in so many different ways.
Yeah, I can see that.
And, you know, one of the things that I've noticed with John, one of his real superpowers is that he is extremely well organized. And other than being very driven, of course, but John will be planning 5 or 6 trips at any one time. And we will sometimes be sitting in the jungle waiting for a diker to appear. He'll be tapping away on his phone, and he is planning 7 trips down to try and get things done. And is that a trait that you see in yourself as well?
No, I don't think I've ever been in a situation where I've had to organize more than 2 trips at once. I think part of the reason for that is that the birding information is much easier to get. I think that for John, obviously he has great contacts and he knows how to get the information he needs. But I would think that the kinds of information that I need to organize a bird trip someplace is much more accessible and much more publicly available than it would be if I were doing a mammal trip.
Indeed, it's the envy of the information that the bird has had 20 years ago that led me to set up the website.
Yeah,
I have.
Or 30 or 40 years ago. Yeah, absolutely. And I can remember back in 1986, I was trying to become the first person to see all the bird families. And I needed 3 families in South America. And I wrote a letter to Robert Ridgely, who's a specialist in South American birds. And he gave me the information and went off and found the bird. So if I had not known him to be able to write a letter and get that information, I'm not sure how I would have done it otherwise. But now all that information is freely available.
Exactly. Although it is fun to unearth that information, and you know, we're planning a trip to Mexico, trying to figure out where to go for things.
Yeah, I remember when I was living in Malaysia, the word got out in the UK that I was there. So every young Brit on a long trip to Southeast Asia would end up at my front door on a Sunday afternoon or a Saturday afternoon and ring the bell. And would go out to the gate and they'd say, "Does Peter Kastner live here?" And I said, "Yes, come on in." And they'd just gotten off a bus from Taman Negara or something, and they're stinky, sweaty, filthy. So I'd always say, "Go on up and have a nice hot shower. I'll put a cuppa on for you." And they'd go up and give them a nice cup of hot tea and everything would be just fine. But several of those people would, you know, I'd sit at the dinner table and say, "Look, you know, why don't you go here and you can explore this area in Sarawak and maybe you can find the black oriole, or you could go here." And they all would go where the gen was. And one of the things that I enjoyed was going where the gen wasn't. And, you know, going and exploring, I went up to Gunung Mulu in Sarawak and found a Dulit frogmouth. I missed the oriole, unfortunately, which I was hoping to get there. But, it was just completely off the wall. Nobody had been up there. No birders had been up there. And I went up and spent a couple of days camping in the little hut and had a wonderful time. I love the adventure. I discovered a new species of bird in Colombia because I was birding a road that no other birders had birded, as far as I know. It's just a sort of an off the wall sort of place, and found a bird that in that particular spot is not uncommon.
Yeah, we see very similar things in the mammal watching community. I think the point is that people have typically a limited amount of time that they can take off, and normally a limited amount of money as well. And so if they're going to go to an area to look for a certain species, they will almost invariably go to a place where someone has seen it in the past, rather than taking the risk of going out and spending the money and perhaps not seeing it somewhere new. Yeah. And that's actually one of the strengths where when you do find a place which does have that particular species, then there can be a lot of money that pours into that area simply because everyone follows in your footsteps.
Yeah, and that's a wonderful segue into sort of the importance of wildlife, international wildlife tourism as a means towards conservation. And I just gave a lecture last Wednesday to a conservation group here in the United States making that point that, you know, when we go in, I had a photograph in the Moratus Mountains. We were looking for the newly described Moratus white eye and the Moratus blue flycatcher. And I calculated there's something like 22 people who were directly involved that got money in their pockets from the fact that we are there looking for those two birds. And, you know, the more people that you can get up there, right now it's like one group a year, but if you can get three or four groups a year, it would start making an economic difference to these people.
Amen.
Yep, exactly. Now, another trait that Charles accuses me of is that he says I'm lucky. And I'm a statistician, so I don't really believe in luck. But at the same time, I must admit I do. And I think of some of the things I've bumped into with relatively little effort. Do you believe in luck? Do you think there are lucky birders?
I do think that there are lucky birders. And there are two angles of it. I really do believe they're lucky birders. And one of the luckiest I know is my older brother, Hank. And he has his wife told him about something years and years ago called a lucky stone. And a lucky stone, okay, I've got one right here, is a stone that has a white or a pale line through it. So it's a dark stone that has a light line through it. Here's a lucky stone that I keep in my backpack. So I have it with me all the time. And Hank believes in lucky stones. So he'll be going off and he'll find a lucky stone and then keep it. And he says that brings him good luck. Well, just in November, Hank and I were birding in Western Brazil, middle of the day, forest dead as a doornail, except for some insects. Nothing was coming. We were playing a tape for a Rondonia warbling ant bird. Nothing. We've been out there for most of an hour. I suddenly realized that I had my lucky stone in my backpack. So I pull out the lucky stone. Hank holds it in his hand. He's rubbing the lucky stone. Within like 2 minutes, this bird flies right in front of Hank and lands on top of some dead sticks. Like, it was kind of like a thicket that didn't have any leaves on it. It was just a thicket of dead branches. And sits right up on top, and it's the warbling ant bird, just like that. And the weird thing is that warbling ant birds are really, really hard to see. We'd seen another species that morning. I never got any kind of a photograph of it. And this one with the lucky stone is sitting right out in the open, right in front of us. And it's incredible, absolutely amazing. We took a picture afterwards, and pointing to the lucky stone, the huge smiles on our faces. It's remarkable. And I really believe that my brother brings good luck. There's no question about it. I've had some amazing things happen to me over the years. And whether they're luck or serendipity or whatever you call it, I've really had a very blessed life in a lot of different ways. I've had some amazing adventures and amazing experiences.
Oh, fantastic. Now, Charles and I have seen what lucky stone looks like because Peter held one up to the camera, and you haven't, I'm afraid, and I'm not going to tell anyone because I want one. It's a secret reference. I know exactly what I'm looking for. I'm going to the beach as soon as we finish.
I know. I was contemplating the fact that should Peter need a side hustle in his retirement, he could find and flog
lucky stones.
Absolutely. Blessed by Peter Kestner. Yeah.
Right.
You know, I have an excellent photograph of my brother and me and our lucky stone from Brazil. Like, if that's something you could put on your website or something, I could shoot the picture over to you.
Absolutely, we'll include that in the notes. Yep.
Yeah, that'll be
very
great.
Cool.
So, Peter, you are knocking on the door of having seen 10,000 species of birds. Of those 10,000, are there any that really jump out as having given you particular pleasure to have seen?
Oh, without a doubt, the bird that I discovered, the Grallaria caesonii, Cundinamarca anpetto, is, I mean, has to be when you discover something new to science, it's pretty remarkable.
And did you know right away that it was new?
I knew that it was new for Colombia because I lived in Colombia and I knew the birds of Colombia, all of them. So I knew that it was a new species to Colombia. But at the time, I didn't know that it was not, say, a Bolivian or Peruvian species. At that point, I knew it also wasn't an Ecuadorian bird. But I didn't know that much about the Peruvian and Bolivian birds that it could be say, a Peruvian species that was just unknown that far north, that it was just a range extension of a bird that was found farther south along the Andes. So when I saw it, I knew it was new for Colombia, but I didn't know it was a completely new species. But I got home and looked in the Birds of South America with Meyer DeShaughnessy, and it took about 3 seconds to realize that it was in fact a brand new species.
And then what did you do? What were your next steps?
The next steps was I had a tape recording of it. It took me 45 minutes to get a view of the bird. I heard it off in the distance and it sounded interesting, so I made a recording and then played it, and the bird came back and made a better recording and played it and it came back. In fact, all of these recordings are in eBird. It was, I think, the 13th of October, 1989. But if you go to in eBird and search for the Cundinamarca anpetta, you'll find the earliest record of it is mine, obviously. But I actually have the discovery and my initial description, which I described the bird on my tape recorder, the very first time that I saw it. So I had a recording of it, and I made copies, and I sent that to a couple of people that were very good on bird songs in South America, and they both agreed that it was a new species. And then I was very fortunate. I was living in Bogota, Colombia, and just about that time, an American ornithologist named Gary Stiles had moved to Colombia. And I contacted Gary, and he came out, since he's a professional and had permits. He came out, and we spent a weekend camping at the location, setting up mist nets. And then we finally were able to capture one bird, and that became the type specimen. And he described it and named it after me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's great.
All right. Moving on to the meat and vegetable of the podcast. You must have seen some great mammals while you're out birding. Could you share some of your favorite mammal encounters?
Oh my goodness, I've had so many great mammal encounters. It's hard to relate them, but they're one of them. It's interesting. One of them, I have no idea what the mammal is. But I was 1991. I was hiking up very early before sunrise, maybe 4 or 5 in the morning, hiking up the mountains at Chibodas in western Java, going up the mountain there, Gunung Gedhi. And as I was climbing up the mountain, off to the west, the full moon was setting, and a giant flying squirrel, which must have been almost a meter long, leapt out of a tree and went down the slope and passed right in front of the setting full moon and went down into the valley. And it was just such an amazing, amazing adventure. I mean, to this day, I can still picture it. This beautiful animal just gliding down the valley in front of the moon. Another sort of adventure I had, I was in the Peace Corps, 1976 to 78. So I was sort of trying to figure out exactly what I wanted to do with my life professionally. So I graduated from university in 76 and immediately went over to Eastern Congo, which was then called Zaire. And we had a 10-week training program where we learned to speak French, because that was the language of instruction in the schools, and also learned how to teach. So we were at this Peace Corps training at a place called Bukavu, Zaire, which is on the south side of Lake Kivu. And on several weekends, we were able to go up to Kahuzi Park, which is about 30 kilometers or so northwest of Bukavu. And once I was up there birding by myself, and a whole family group of gorillas approached the road where I was birding. Now, I had seen a special that aired in 1976 in the United States that talked about how gorillas were actually vegetarian, and they weren't, you know, they didn't eat people and all that kind of stuff. But these gorillas were not particularly happy with me blocking their transect across the road. So they would rush out of the forest and beat their chest, just like in the movies. And then they'd go back and they'd get a small tree and rip it out of the ground and throw it around. And it was really an amazing display of aggression. They're, you know, trying to impress me with how big and strong they were, which was very, very impressive. And I just sort of cowered on the road had an angle, so it was sort of raised in the middle and sloped off on the sides. So I went over to the backside of the road where I could sort of stay out of sight mostly and keep an eye on these fantastic gorillas. And they came and they were making a lot of noise and pounding their chests and ripping vegetation apart and throwing it around. And then after a while, they got tired of it and chuffed off and never saw them again. But my heart was beating 1,000 miles a second. I mean, it was just incredible. I didn't know, you know, they say that they're vegetarian, but these are animals that are ripping trees out of the ground with their bare hands. So, you know, you can only imagine what they would do to me if they were decided to take it out on me.
Yeah, wow. I think it was George Shallow, wasn't it, Charles? Who was the famous biologist who we had on the podcast. He was the first person really to let the world know that they weren't these, they were a peaceful animal. So it's extraordinary. Yes. It was so recently that we didn't know that.
I remember that, you know, peaceful, vegetarian. Wait a minute, he's ripping that tree right out of the ground.
These gorillas haven't read that.
Counting his death in anger. I don't know. what kind of sample size are we working with, Dr. Fowler?
That's right. Indeed. So, Peter, do you keep notes on the mammals that you see?
There are not a lot of places where mammal watching is as satisfying as bird watching, in my view. One of them, of course, is Africa, where you have the big game. And when I was living in Africa for 2 years, and I did keep track of most of the mammals, unfortunately, I was in the Ituri forest and, you know, the Congo rainforest, and saw lots of primates and did not document those, which is really unfortunate. Because I'm sure I saw some pretty good monkeys and do not have record of them. But one thing that has changed in my life during the lockdown, we were all on a short leash. So one of the things I started doing is I started using iNaturalist. And in iNaturalist, I would document everything except for birds. So I document my birds in eBird, but I document plants, insects, mammals, all in iNaturalist. And the problem with iNaturalist is that you need to have some evidence, or I need to have like a photograph. So a lot of the mammals that I saw early in my life, I don't have any documentation to put them into iNaturalist. But for the last several years, I've been documenting all the mammals that I see and going out of my way to document them. so that I can build up my list in iNaturalist.
Mm. And when you were in the Inturi, you didn't happen to trip over an Okapi, did you?
Yes and no. I obviously that was a huge thing that I wanted to see, and when I somehow the word got out that I was in the Peace Corps and was in this wild remote area of northeastern Congo, and a guy named Joel Abramson that had one of the very first bird tour companies called Bird Bonanzas contacted me and asked me if I would lead a tour around that part of the world. To my knowledge, it's the only bird tour it's ever been out there. And we were supposed to go look for the Congo peacock. I had a location for it. And the plane that we were going to borrow, flew over the village where we were supposed to fly. And another aircraft had landed in the mud and had flipped over and was sitting upside down in the middle of the landing strip. So we had to change our plans at the last minute. So instead of going there, we went out deeper into the Ituri forest to an Okapi reserve. And we saw Okapis in the Ituri forest, but they were inside of a mammoth pen that was, I don't know, maybe 2 or 3 hectares, but it had a fence all the way around it. So they were not truly wild, but we did see them in their native environment. And it was pretty impressive.
Wow. Something we're trying to get to desperately. It's just not safe at the moment.
No, yeah. that's an understatement. But you know, it's interesting. I was a science teacher in a tiny village in a place called Nyankundi in northeastern Zaire. The Peace Corps volunteer that preceded me ended up marrying a researcher, and she has spent her whole life doing research in the Ituri forest. And they have published some trail cam pictures of Congo peacocks. And so I would love to go and visit her and see the Congo peacock. But I haven't heard anything about her copies being on offer there.
Mm-hmm. So obviously you've seen some fabulous mammals. Do you have a theory about why mammal watching is so much the distant poorer cousin of bird watching in terms of popularity?
you need to be a very sophisticated person to enjoy mammals. One third of the world's mammals are rodents. Another third are bats. So many of them are impossible to identify without looking at their dentition or some other very, very negligible anatomical characteristic. And then of the other third that are round, probably two-thirds or three-quarters of those are nocturnal. So the number of beasts that are, you know, available to see is not great. Although Carlos Bocos just did a mammal trip to Irian and Jaya, and they got, 60 species of mammals or something. Some amazing, but I mean, he is a creature of the night and a really remarkable and unique human being. And you know, I think it was only through his amazing personality that they managed to get 60 mammals. But I think in terms of mammal watching becoming mainstream, I would not bet on it. You know, birds are pretty. I'm sitting here. There's a cardinal, a pure red bird, sitting out in the open, feeding on my feeder right now. You know, if I see a mammal today, it'll be a gray squirrel that's, you know, climbing up in the tree, and even that probably only see it once every couple of weeks, whereas the birds are at my feeder every day.
Yeah, no, understood. It's a conversation we have quite often, obviously, and it often comes down to the same the same ideas. Although no one's called us sophisticated before, Charles. Not, they might have called you that, but never me. So I'll take that one.
We're making progress. We're making progress. It's, yes, and I should add that both John and I were all on that mammal trip to Irianjaya with Carlos. Ah. And he is indeed a remarkable human being. And one thing that we talk about quite a lot on the podcast is how the introduction of thermal imaging cameras images has just simply revolutionized the way that we do mammal watching. And now we can really have a chance at seeing some of these nocturnal species, which previously just simply were entirely off the menu.
I enjoy seeing new mammals. And I remember a couple of years ago, I was in Namibia and I learned that there is a fairly unique creature called a dassy rat that lives in the colonies of rock dassies on the rocks in Namibia. And when I learned about this dassy rat, I think it's in its own family, it's a really very unusual animal, I scoured all the dassy colonies until I found one and got a nice photograph of it. So, you know, to a certain extent, you know, mammal watching, when they are diurnal, when they are identifiable by just looking at them, to me has many of the same elements of listing birds.
Well, what changes have you seen in birding since you took it up as a hobby?
The main difference, quite frankly, is information. When I was young, I had a pair of $20 Tasco binoculars that would go bad pretty quickly, and we'd take them apart. And but the optics, I mean, these were 7x35; they were pretty crummy. I now have some very nice Swarovski 10 power bins, but in terms of the sort of evolution, the technological evolution in optics, it's not that huge. I mean, you're still looking through the same type of instrument, and you're still getting somewhere between 7 and 10 power magnification. And obviously, the Swarovski bins are spectacular to look through, but you know, it's still the same thing that we're doing. It's not a revolution like the night vision scopes have done to mammal watching, and indeed to bird watching too. But the big difference is information. In the old days, you need to know people. You need to know somebody that had lived in a place or gone to a place or maybe had written a bird report having been to a place, which the bird reports were extremely helpful. There was a book, Finding Birds Around the World by John Gooders, I think it was Peter Alden and Gooders. It was published in the 1970s. It had really pretty good little maps and species lists for I don't know, about 200 places around the world. So you're getting just, you know, very bits and pieces of information. There were very few, if any, local guides. And, you know, you had people like, say, Ben King, who took people around Asia because he was an expert in Asia. You had people like Bob Ridgely that would take people out in South America, but they had very few local guides. And now the guiding industry has completely changed, where you have, I saw an advertisement today for a South American, an Ecuadorian guide from South America who was selling tours to Vietnam. And, you know, he's going to Vietnam not because he's an expert in Vietnam, because there's such good local guides that he can go and be a successful professional guide. And indeed, you know, I'm 70 years old. I have lost a couple of steps in terms of my hearing and my eyesight and my stamina from when I was 30 years old and a hotshot world birder. But I can still be a successful bird tour guide because the local guys have got the ears and the eyes to find the birds. And my role is more towards making sure that all the clients are on the birds, they all see it, to explain to them what they're seeing and why it's different maybe tell them stories about it, you know, giving them some context for the sightings, and also making sure that they're happy and enjoying themselves the entire time. So it's a slight, you know, it's an evolved sort of thing, but it's all about the information, and you can, you know, the local people have all the information now, so you have excellent local guides. You can plan a trip using eBird or other fonts of information. There's just, I mean, there's just so much information out there. It's just crazy. And 40, 50 years ago, it was very, very different.
Indeed. Now, Peter, I'm going to hazard a wild guess that not everything on your trips has always gone exactly to plan. Would you care to tell us some of the stories of your misadventures along the way?
Oh my goodness! Probably the best misadventure story I have was in August of 1979. I finished up my Peace Corps experience in August of 1978. And I traveled through West Africa. I got home in about December. And as I'd mentioned earlier, Bird Bonanzas had asked me to do a tour in northeastern Congo. And Joel Abramson, the owner and founder of Bird Bonanzas, came along on that tour. And he was impressed enough with the way I had done that. I had never done any kind of a tour before. It was the first time. That he offered me to come along on a tour of Colombia as an assistant leader with Steve Hilty. So Steve Hilty was the main leader, and I was his sidekick. I'd never been to Colombia before. We ended up seeing some 700 birds, and 450 of them were lifers for me as a tour guide. And at the end of that trip, we spent a week in the town of Leticia, Colombia, which is down on the Amazon. And the Bird Bonanzas had chartered a boat, these tramp steamers. And we went down the Amazon and then up a river called the Javari River, which is the border between Peru and Brazil, sort of south of Leticia, Colombia. And we spent most of a week sleeping in hammocks on this boat, this open boat, eating fish out of the river. And we had like 6 or 7 cases of this nasty yellow soda that we drank, the awful stuff. But anyway, it was a wonderful, wonderful time in areas very, very rarely visited by anybody, even now. And on the way back, as we got back to the main part of the Amazon River, we came down the Rio Javari, which is under 7 or 8 hours. Then we hit the main river and we start going upstream towards Leticia, which is only a few hours steaming. Steve Hilty took the launch from the boat. Our boat is probably 40, 50 feet long, but 16, 17 meters. And he decided to take the launch from this boat and go up to Leticia to make sure that the hotels and everything were all set up for our arrival. So he left me in charge on the boat. At this point, it's dark, it's night. Now, the Amazon River is very wide. I mean, you ask somebody how big the Amazon is, it's, you know, it's 20, 30 kilometers across and at times and places. But there is a very narrow channel where the large ships can go. And large ships can go a long way up the Amazon, but the channel is only maybe 100 or 200 meters wide, and it's very deep. So it might be 50 meters deep, whereas the rest of this 20 or 30 kilometers is only maybe 5 or 10 meters deep. So we are in this narrow shipping channel in the dark. We don't have any lights on. And next thing we know, there's a giant freighter, a huge ship that maybe 10 or 15 times bigger than us, coming right towards us because we're both in this little narrow shipping channel. So the pilot of our boat, I was in the wheelhouse at the time, makes a hard left turn, and this big ship hits us amidships and pokes a hole about maybe 30 centimeters in diameter, right at the water level. And next thing you know, the water is just pouring into the bottom of the boat. I go down into the engine room, and I can see the water coming in. It's going all over this diesel engine that's been running for, at this point, probably 8 or 10 hours. And obviously, we're in real trouble because we're in very deep water. We're in the middle of the Amazon. We have no lights. The ship that hit us has bounced off and kept going downstream. They never stopped to give us any aid. And here I am in charge. The other thing is that the guys running the boat are all Brazilian. They speak Portuguese, and I speak very poor Spanish. So I have almost no way of communicating with them. Everybody's running around screaming and yelling. So I muster all the clients together. I think we had maybe 7 or 8 clients. And the boat, because we made a hard left turn, the boat was going away from the shipping channel. And this is very good, because eventually we got far enough away from the shipping channel that as our ship sank, I got everybody to climb up onto the top of the boat, and the ship eventually sank in the shallow water, and the very top of the boat, maybe 10 or 20 centimeters, was above the water. So we were safe, and we were standing there on the top of this thing. I don't know, maybe 3 meters by 4 meters, something like the top of the wheelhouse. And we're just standing there in the middle of the Amazon, in the middle of the night, then no lights. After a while, some river dolphins came up, and you could hear them going, trying to find out what was going on. And we were just there. Now, fortunately, because Steve Hilty had taken the launch away, after a few hours, he realized that we hadn't arrived. So he contacted the police, and they put together a search party, and they eventually found us later that night. But we spent, I don't know, several hours sort of enjoying the nighttime and the fantastic stars in the middle of the Amazon River, being accompanied by some river dolphins. But it was a truly frightful event, because we had no idea. I didn't realize how narrow the shipping channel was at the time. I knew that it was deep enough for a giant ship to run us over. So I knew that the water was quite deep, but I didn't realize just how narrow it was. And I had no idea that we were going to sink. And going back to lucky, I guess, that, you know, that could have happened. That could have ended up in a very, very different way. We could have been broken in two by the ship and not just had a hole punched in our side. We could have not made it to the shallow water and gone down in, you know, 20 or 30 meters of water. It would have had a very, very different outcome.
Wow. Terrifying. Yeah.
Is that an adventure?
It's definitely a misadventure. I'm just imagining you all moving up to the sort of higher levels of the ship.
As the ship goes down,
waiting up, you know, to have so little to play with at the very end. It's like a scene from a James Bond movie.
It was amazing. And you know, we all lived to tell the tale.
And it wasn't enough to put you off birding in future.
Obviously. Oh my goodness, no. That's a great story.
So speaking of which, at some point this year, you should see your 10,000th bird.
I should.
What next? Are you going to hang up your binoculars and play pickleball?
Oh my goodness, no.
What would you do?
Oh my goodness, no. I think my wife sort of has in the back of her mind that I am going to slow down. And maybe to a certain extent I will, but I birding is just too much a part of my being. But you know, I'm birding as I'm talking to you, because right on the other side of the computer are my bird feeders. So I'm, you know, I've seen chipping sparrows, song sparrows, white-throated sparrows, dark-eyed juncos, northern cardinals, just as we've been talking. I'll certainly will continue, and I've got places to go where I still need quite a few birds. In fact, Carlos Bocas. I sent Carlos Bocas my Iri and Jaya wants list. He says he can get me 50 lifers in a month in Iri and Jaya. Wow. I can get 50 lifers in about 4 to 6 weeks in Polynesia. So yeah, I know that there's still quite a few birds. I think I'll probably do two things. One is I will do more guiding. This last year, I decided not to do any rock jumper tours because I wanted to give priority to the full-time leaders. But next year, I'm signed up for leading four rock jumper tours. And part of it is that the last couple of years, I've spent a lot of money on organized tours and custom tours and things. And it's not sustainable. I'm not a rich person. I've made a big commitment to get to 10,000. So that will change a bit. I'll probably do more tours like Polynesia, where I can take my wife. We both enjoy scuba diving and identifying reef fish and that sort of thing. So it will likely evolve quite a bit, because I really have, in the last couple of years, I've been really making a big push and doing a lot of tours and things that that tend to be fairly expensive.
Sounds good. I couldn't imagine you were going to stop. So it's good to know you have so many great plans to keep going after 10,000.
Yeah, and I've got lots of birds to see. I mean, it really is interesting that I can go to a place and see 50 lifers at this point. It's exactly. I got 200 lifers in the last year. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah.
You'd think the law of diminishing returns would kick in at some point.
Exactly. But yeah, it's the same with mammals. It hasn't for me. I mean, I've got a lot further to go than you proportionally, but I kept thinking, get to 1,000, it'd be hard. Get to 1,500, it'd be hard. But still, I saw 100 new ones last year, and I'm over 2,000. So yes, it's
now you've got your night vision goggles. So
exactly. So when Charles and Peter and I recorded this episode, it was back in February, and Peter was planning to see his 10,000th bird in the middle of this year. However, things changed, and so we felt we had to bring Peter back on for a couple of minutes to record a postscript, because as many of you will know, he saw his 10,000th bird in February, not long after we recorded the show. Peter has very kindly joined us from Eastern Mindanao, where it's late in the evening, and he's somewhere between his 10,012th and 10,013th bird now. Peter, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be back with you guys.
Yeah, good to see you again, Peter. And congratulations.
Yes, congratulations. Obviously, first of all, congratulations. Well, what a feat.
Thank you.
Absolutely remarkable.
It's a lot of fun. On this last trip, a couple of days ago, I saw my 10,000th bird again, the orange-tufted spider hunter. And just two nights ago, I was at the spot where I saw the orange-tufted spider hunter for number 10,000. So both of those experiences were kind of fun.
Oh, fantastic. Get to relive it all again.
Yes.
So when we spoke last time, I think you had plans to see a puffin. I can't remember, is it a horn puffin or a tufted puffin? Is your
tufted plan? Puffin? Yes, tufted puffin. It's a lower 48 bird. A bird that's found in the state of Oregon, which is quite remarkable that I could have a bird so close to home that I haven't seen yet.
Exactly. But then things changed, and the record came on a lot more quickly than anyone was expecting.
Yeah, it changed. It did change. Well. You know, I have been fairly straightforward in my goal and telling people what I'm planning to do. And I've always understood that by being honest and open about it, that I sort of was putting a target on my back in case somebody decided to try to beat me. And it turned out that somebody did. And his name was Jason Mann. I had seen his number in Surf Birds over the years, and he had been up in the 9,000s, I think it was 9,600 as of about a year ago. And of course, many of your listeners may know that Surf Birds sort of imploded last fall in September, October. Jason Mann was putting his numbers back in October, and as of October 27th, he had put his number in as 9,604, I think it was. Anyway, I actually posted it on Facebook to see if anybody knew what was going on with Surf Birds. And in that post at Facebook, I had done a screen grab of the Surfbird site that showed his number. So he had entered that in October. Well, I learned in January that he was claiming 9,904 birds, an increase of 300 birds in just a couple of months. So I knew that there was something up. And then shortly after that, he posted 9,943. So he was only a couple of dozen behind me at that point. I was at 66. So what, 17 behind me? Crazy. I mean, it just all of a sudden he was, you know, right there. And about that same time, an article that I'd written back in June of 2023 was published in January of 2024 in Birding Magazine, which laid out my plan for getting to the Tufted Puffin and having a quite nice celebration with my family and friends in Oregon in the summertime. But I realized that with Jason so close that I needed to move up my plan. So I did a quick trip to Taiwan and picked up 15 birds there. So that brought me 66, 15, that's 81. Mm-hmm. So I only needed 19 birds, and I knew that I could go to the Philippines and get 19 birds pretty quickly. As I was coming back from Taiwan, and this would have been February 1st or 2nd, somewhere around there, I learned that Jason was in Colombia and was adding new birds at a clip of about 10 per day. So I know that it would just be a matter of a few days when he reached 10,000. So I got home on a Friday night from Taiwan, and my wife said, "You've got to get on the next plane and go back. You can't let this guy beat you." My thought was, I don't have any choice because he's already there. He's seeing the birds. Even if I immediately go to the Philippines, I can't catch him. My brother Hank also 100% just go. He even offered to pay my plane ticket. Oh. And so anyway, I arrived Friday night, and 6 o'clock Sunday morning, I was heading back to the Philippines. I got to the Philippines. I'd sent Pete Simpson, who's sort of the number one guide in Mindanao, and also he works as a ground agent for all the major tour companies, so he's great with logistics. And I said, "Hey, Pete, I'm coming. What can you do for me?" And he, amazing guy, he dropped everything and put together a 4 or 5 day trip for me. He was very busy. He was guiding some people himself, but he took a day off and showed me around, showed me a bunch of birds on my first 24 hours there. And eventually I got the bird on February 9th at Peacock, this reserve where I've been birding today, and in eastern Mindanao. And as within minutes of observing it, I got a nice picture. So I screen grabbed, or the back of the camera picture of the bird, and I'd made up a little sign that said 10,000, put that out on Facebook. And it turned out, just by remarkable coincidence, that just 12 hours before I posted a photograph of 10,000, Jason had published on a Colombian nature tourism website a claim that he was one of the best bird watchers in the world, and he had broken the record by seeing 10,000 birds. And there are a couple of things that happened that were just extraordinary. Both of these events happened at the same time, his claim and my report. And amazingly, if Surfbirds had been working and he had just published his number on Surfbirds, nobody would have any idea what his list comprised of. But since Surfbirds had not been working, the alternative for him to get his list out into public was to do it through iGoTerra. By putting in iGoTerra, you actually have to put in the birds. You can't just put in a number, although they've changed it. They now, with the demise of Surfbirds, iGoTerra has a free, just post your number facility, but they didn't have that in January. So Jason Mann, instead of just putting his number out as he would have been able to do in Surfbirds last year, he had to do it in iGoTerra, which meant that he actually had to put his sightings in. And when this extraordinary coincidence of the two events happening at the same time within 12 hours, which is just, I mean, it's incredible to think something that's taken the history of the world to do, and then it happens twice in 12 hours. People started looking at his list, and I didn't get involved in that, but several of my very good friends did, and there was a very lively discussion on Bird Forum and some other areas. And it turned out that he had a lot of birds on his list that raised some eyebrows among the people that were looking at the sightings. And eventually there was enough criticism, I guess is the proper word, criticism of his sightings, that he put out a post saying that, in fact, he conceded that I had seen the 10,000 birds before he did, which is very nice of him. So yeah, it was crazy. If anybody wants to, there are a couple of weird things out there. There's the thread in Bird Forum is very, very unusual, and also there's a very interesting TikTok video out there that last time I checked had been viewed something like 3 million times. I didn't know there could be 3 million people interested in birds.
Wow.
Enough to watch a TikTok video about 10,000 birds.
Oh, fantastic.
But anyway, it really took off. It's crazy. But the takeaway for me, quite frankly, and the number one thing for me is an extraordinary, extraordinary, profound feeling of gratitude and appreciation for all the people around the world that stepped up to defend me and support me in the light of these two competing events that happened 12 hours apart on February 9th.
I mean, as you say, I remember seeing all this as it happened on Facebook, and just, of course, the coincidence was beyond conceivable. This would just have to happen randomly, and then all the comments coming in, it was very interesting to read. And there's certainly a lot of love for you, Peter, out there, and I think I felt just sorry that your thunder had been taken away slightly, that this was your moment, and while you were enjoying that bird, there was all this other things were happening, and you maybe didn't celebrate quite as you wanted to, but
not even close. I was, in fact, I was in this hotel room,
right,
on February 9th. This nasty, not a nasty hotel, but it's an old, dirty place, and in the middle of nowhere. Yeah. That's a far cry from celebrating with my family and friends in on the coast of Oregon.
Yes. The idea that you spent 40 years tracking down these birds, and then in the end it turns into an absolute sprint. Although on the flip side to that, you can say that it does make for a good thrilling story. I can almost imagine, if there are 3 million people watching a TikTok video of this, I can almost imagine a Hollywood movie coming along at some point.
Absolutely, I can easily imagine it, yeah.
you just need to start thinking about who's going to play you, Peter.
No, I don't even want to go down that one. But no, you're absolutely right. Because of that, the story has really taken off. I mean, it was on the front page of the New York freaking Times. I mean, seriously, how if I had just seen 10,000 birds, nobody would have cared.
Yeah.
But the fact that you have this human interest dimension to it just is extraordinary.
Oh, absolutely. It was remarkable. And I have to point out just to the listeners that the hotel room that you're sitting in has peach-colored walls and a very bright floral curtain. So just to set the scene over there a little bit. But regardless, Peter, that's an astonishing achievement. You are the first person to ever have seen 10,000 birds in history. Your name will go down in the pantheon of birding forever. So congratulations.
Thank you. I don't feel that special, but I certainly, as I say, that the number of people that have stepped up and supported me and thanked me and congratulated me, I mean, it is absolutely overwhelming. Literally thousands of people, and I'm absolutely humbled by it. I'm just a guy that goes out and looks at birds. I put my pants on just like you guys do, and I'm not anything special. I just have had some remarkable opportunities, and an awful lot of help along the way. And all I can say is thank you to everybody.
Even with 3 million people watching your TikTok video, you're still as humble as a month ago. So good to see you haven't changed. Peter Kaestner, thank you so much. That was fascinating to meet the world's most accomplished birder and to hear your stories. Thank you so much for joining us. And I'm hoping mammals will continue to feature in your life, not to the same extent as birds possibly, but I know you love them too. So thank you for joining us.
I certainly do. And I must say, when I saw that trip to Irianjaya with Carlos Bocas, I was jealous. I would have loved to have done that. That would have been great. So yeah, I'll continue to watch birds and continue to watch mammals. And thank you all. Thank both Charles and John for having me. It's been a very enjoyable discussion, and look forward to seeing you all in the flesh someday. Cheers.
Yeah. Thank you, Peter. Appreciate it. Bye-bye. Cheers.
You've been listening to Mammal Watching with Charles Foley and John Hall. You can find other episodes at mammalwatching.com/podcast.